Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
Nice to be on the show.
Hilliard, with rising mortgage rates, people are wondering, how can I afford to stay in my home and not default on it and have the bank take it back? I've put so much money into it already, I'd hate to see it go. Are the banks repossessing homes, or are they coming up with solutions to sky-high mortgage rates?
They are not taking any actions to put people out of their homes yet. And what they're doing instead, in my opinion, is almost as bad and maybe even worse. And that is they're extending the amortization on the mortgage. So a bunch of people took out variable rate mortgages in 2020, in 2021 and 2022, when rates were down at 1.5-2% on variable rates. Now that rates are up at 5-7%, even as high as 10% at one bank, Scotiabank, on those same variable rate mortgages, people's payments are jumping. And of course, what happens then is they can't afford to make the monthly payments. So payments maybe go from $1,500 a month to $4,000 a month, or some ridiculous number like that. So in order to fix that, what the banks are doing, and it's showing up in the bank reports that are just coming out this week, is they're extending the amortization to 35 years plus. So two of the banks that reported so far, CIBC and TD, both show 35-year or more, greater amortization on their schedules. More than 25% of all their mortgages are in, and this is brand new. Last year, you go back and look at it, and it's zero. They had zero mortgages that were 35-year amortizations. At the moment, they're at 25%, and it's probably climbing. And this is because people need to smooth out their payments over a longer period of time. The problem with that, of course, is that they pay way more interest. If they, they might find a way to pay it back faster, but the amortization schedule, if they just made the payments that the bank is offering them over 35 years, they would pay more, way more than double the cost of the original cost of the mortgage at current interest rates. So basically, people will be indebted for the rest of their lives and well into their retirement, and may never be able to pay off the mortgage. And maybe people are okay with that. I don't know. I talked to some people a few years ago, and they felt they would never pay off their mortgages. They would just make the monthly payments, and that'd be fine.
In Hong Kong, people take out 100-year mortgages. They fully expect the third generation of their family to be the ones who get the property free and clear. Will Canadians accept that?
Yeah, it's so, I don't know. I'm from the older generation, and it's just so far against what we were brought up with. The idea was you pay your mortgage off in your high income earnings by age 50, 55. You have your mortgage paid off. The kids are basically out on their own. You don't need to support them anymore. And then you've got 10 years of high income until 65, when you can save up some money for retirement, and then you retire at 65. And of course, in those days, a lot of people were offered a defined benefit pension plan as well. So they didn't need huge savings. They just needed a modest savings. And then they lived off their pension. Nowadays, if you had your mortgage payments going into retirement, you'd have to have some pretty good savings or good income in retirement. And of course, people don't have those defined benefit pension plans anymore. So in theory, it might work, but in practice, I think it's going to be very dangerous. Of course, our practice as investment managers for a bunch of individuals and families shows that, money gets tight in retirement. even for people that have saved up substantial retirement nest eggs and have them invested. And also people's attitude towards spending changes quite a bit too. So to have that monthly payment, that mortgage payment going out when you're retired and there's no income coming in, I think that would be psychologically very painful.
However, we've seen rents skyrocket recently, and rents never really seem to come down all that much. When they do come down, at least with a locked-in mortgage, you know how much you're going to have to pay, even if you haven't retired your mortgage debt. Would that be an advantage in the long run?
Yeah, that, you know, to have that mortgage payment fixed, you know, and of course, every 5 years in Canada, the mortgage comes up for the rate on the mortgage comes up for renewal. The amortization schedule doesn't have to change, but the interest rate can change, and it can go up or it can go down. And people might save up a little extra money and pay down the principal. That's one of the best things you can do if you've got a big mortgage, is to put an extra payment down. Quite a few mortgages, all the mortgages seem to be a bit different, but some of them allow you to once a year put 10% additional principal down, which can have a huge impact on your on the total interest paid over the amortization, because it shortens up the schedule so much. So who's to say those people that have now are in this bind because of the high property prices that they got locked in at with extremely low interest rates, and now the interest rates are soaring. They might get out of the bind by just cutting out other spending and paying down their mortgage faster. And the problem with that, of course, is that's going to affect the Canadian economy. And we just had the results come out a couple of days ago, where the fourth quarter Canadian economy was basically flat. There was no growth at all. So that's borderline recession, and that will be what happens when people invest too much money into housing and the interest rates rise and they have to start supporting that home. You know, studies in the U.S. show that people do not give up on their home, even when the home is severely underwater or upside down, as the various terms indicating that the mortgage is bigger than the house valuation after the house price drops. Only a tiny fraction of those that were eligible to walk away from their homes took advantage of that. Most of them just kept paying their mortgage. And it was to their financial disadvantage to do so. They would have been better off to walk away, but they didn't, because they either felt morally obligated or they didn't want to move, or any number of reasons. So people keep paying their mortgages, but that means they might not make their car payments. They might not, you know, go on vacation. They might not do all kinds of extra discretionary items and that would impact the economy in Canada quite a bit. Restaurant meals, all kinds of things might get cut back, and that's what happens. And then we got a society that's just hunkered down, paying off these massive debts that they incurred on this housing bubble that didn't need to happen.
When you're in a situation like this in Vancouver, apparently we have the most empty office towers, and they're building more.
Yeah, I can't believe that. It's just unbelievable.
Is there any solution to that?
Well, the office towers, it's a real mystery to me, because I know a lot of people, and I'm in this category too, that I was working part-time from home before COVID hit, and then after COVID we were told to stay home for several months, and then of course, in that environment, I got all set up more permanently at home, and now I just go in once or twice a week, or zero times a week, depending on how many in-person meetings I need to have. And a lot of people would prefer not to go downtown to a meeting with their financial advisor; they'd rather just do it online or meet for coffee someplace else. The offices, it's got, you know, we've got beautiful offices. Coincidentally, we built a new office out in the downtown tower around the same time as COVID, so they're you know, got all the latest features, and it's really nice to be there and nice to see the people. But having said all that, I think that's an area that where a lot of corporations will be cutting back and indulging people's desire to not have to do that long commute every day, twice a day, and if they can get their work done from home, that's just as well. Now, some people need to be, they're working on a design team or something like that. Tesla, Elon Musk is pretty insistent that people have to come to the physical location. But that's a little bit different if you're working on that kind of a project. But for a lot of people, they can do their work from home, and why not? You know, it saves a bunch of money, saves a bunch of time, and it works just as fine.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, small businesses in downtown Victoria, BC's capital, are complaining about the government's new law that allows provincial employees to work anywhere in the province as long as they get their work done and send it into the capital if they're working for the provincial government. And they say, well, that means 3,000 people a day won't be coming to downtown Victoria. How are we going to survive? Do they have to move out to the burbs, and will our downtown cores become ghost towns?
Well, some of them are already pretty empty. Mm. I mean, Edmonton, the downtown I wouldn't say it's a ghost town, but it's not nearly. I think it's probably about 25% or 30%. And this affects all of the small businesses that are associated with the lunch places, all the different services that gathered downtown when all those towers were full of people. And of course, in Edmonton, they built a bunch of new towers in conjunction with the new Rogers Place hockey rink for the Edmonton Oilers. So there's extra office space there too, and it's definitely not full. And Calgary would be probably the same. I think Calgary had a vacancy rate of 30% before COVID. And of course the vacancy rates, by the way, are vastly understated because a lot of people have long-term leases and they're not using all their space, but it's considered to be fully occupied, even though it's not fully occupied. Toronto will be in the same position. And they were building like crazy. I mean, Toronto had the highest number of high-rise cranes active in North America at around 220 not that long ago. And I checked, and about 100, I can't remember exactly the numbers, but it seemed like about 120, 130 of them were residential, and then the rest of them must have been some office space, some commercial space, that sort of thing. So a lot of building activity going on there. So there's going to be a big surplus, and it's just unfortunate. A lot of people are talking about converting yeah. office spaces to other uses, but it's difficult. Converting office towers, for example, to residential, it doesn't work very well because the plumbing and the various building of the interior walls and all that is completely different for office space versus residential. It's very expensive to do the conversion.
Do they have to start building office buildings with conversion in mind? Maybe make them into seniors housing or medical complexes where doctors and diagnostic equipment and seniors could all be in the same building?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they need to build anymore. I think what appears to be the case is they need more rental housing and they need to build that purpose-built, what they call purpose-built rental housing, where it's designed from the beginning to be affordable and will accommodate families. Because what we've had for the last 30 years or more is people building condos, which are more oriented towards the luxury market, and they're not really designed for families. So there's a huge gap in the housing market there, especially in places like Vancouver and Toronto, but even in other cities as well. Where people are forced to buy, it's really not right for them to be borrowing a huge amount of money to become an owner. They might just be as happy just to rent for a while, if it could be made attractive. Now, at the moment, renting is not attractive at all because the spaces that are available are not suitable for young families, and then also the protection for tenants is not great either. The landlords listening to this would be up in arms when I say this because they feel it's tilted too much in favor of tenants. But the fact that people have to move when they're renting, young couples I've talked to have moved 3 and 4 times in the period of 5 years before they finally, end up buying a house. So that's unacceptable. But the big problem of course, is the affordability. And I don't know how you fix that. It's a very difficult question, but it needs to be fixed.
In BC, a landlord has added 20% to a young couple's rent because they had a baby. And they said, well, according to your agreement, you have an extra tenant.
I mean, there's so many things like that going on in the rental market. It's just really, really terrible. And I don't know what the, you know, as I say, if there was more built, you know, the last time there was a significant amount of affordable housing built was in the 70s, and it was when the government was involved. And and as you and I have discussed before, in the 80s, we bought into the Milton Friedman, Margaret Thatcher point of view, which was let the private sector do it. Well, the private sector didn't want to build affordable housing for rent. It's the private sector wasn't interested in doing that. So and they have their, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. The private sector was responding to the market signals and to the incentives that were given to them. So the government either has to go in and fix the market subsidies and the market incentives so that it makes sense for people to build affordable housing, or the government has to do it themselves. And of course, that'll convince everybody that's watching Canada from outside. Our American neighbors will look at it and say, oh, that's a socialist country. They're building housing for poor people. What a socialist thing to do. But maybe that's what needs to be done.
Well, I mean, you have to ask, do you want to step over homeless people sleeping in your driveway or on your doorstep, or do they deserve housing? And should homeless people even be allowed to move into a city like Vancouver, the third most expensive city in the world?
The two of the famous billionaires in America, infamous maybe, are Donald Trump's father, Fred, and the Kushner family. And they owned a whole bunch of cheap housing in the boroughs in New York City and Manhattan, Queens and Bronx, and they rented them out to poor people. And, of course, the government gave them very attractive incentives to do that if they met certain requirements, and then they would fight. And, in fact, one of them went to jail for breaking the rules. But anyway, not on the Trump side, but on the Kushner side. But it was people lived in those apartments for years, and it worked. You know, it wasn't great. There was gouging going on. There was cheating going on, but somehow it worked. And we just need that. We need something like that without the cheating and the gouging, of course, in Canada as well. We don't have it. It just doesn't exist. The new rental apartments that are being built today for purpose-built rentals, they're just designed as high-rise towers for expensive, you know, $2,000-$4,000 a month rents, and that unless wages go up a lot, that's just not going to help very many people, especially if they have a family.
On the electric car front, Tesla held Investor Day on Wednesday, I should say. How did that go, and how did the market react to it?
Well, they started off. I didn't get through the. Well, first of all, they were late. They were like, well, it's typical, but it was more than half an hour late. So, and then they finally started, and they had teased with they were going to release the master plan, and they gave the master plan, and people can look at it themselves. It's on YouTube, but they were talking about the electrification of the economy and how it could be completely done with renewable energy. And it was pretty convincing. Like, I tend to be in line with those views myself. But I think it might have turned off a lot of people, because a lot of people just aren't there yet and or disagree with that, even Tesla supporters. And they wanted to hear about new models and stuff. And of course, there are a couple of models. There's a Cybertruck. And there's the updated Roadster that have been teased for a number of years. The Cybertruck apparently is going to be out in limited production by the end of this year, and then in full production next year. But everybody was hoping that they would announce a new cheap car, $25,000 US or in that range, and that would of course blow the whole market wide open. and they didn't come out with that. They hinted that they might come out with it sometime soon, but that's what everybody expects. So people got a lecture on how the whole world should switch to renewable energy, which they didn't want to hear. And then they got some long explanations by engineering types about how Tesla is the leader in this and Tesla is the leader in that. And it was very impressive from a manufacturing point of view, from a research and design point of view. But what people wanted to hear about was something that was going to increase Tesla's volume dramatically by coming out with a cheaper car, and that didn't happen. So the stock dropped in the after hours while the event was happening. The stock dropped about 8%, and then the following day on Thursday, by midday, the stock was still down around 8%. And by the way, the stock, it peaked at about $410 a share more than a year ago. It went down to $100 fairly recently, towards the end of 2022. And it had rallied up to about $200, a little over $200, and after this drop on Thursday, it was down about 180 something. So it's still down 55% from its peak. It's up quite a bit from its bottom, but it's not the stock is not doing well now. It's still Elon Musk is still on the borderline of being the richest man in the world. So it's not don't get too worried about Elon's personal wealth. It's still pretty good. But some of the shareholders that bought in when Tesla was $300-$400, they're not very happy that Tesla didn't bring out a big blockbuster announcement on March the 1st the way some people thought they would.
Now, Volkswagen in Asia has come out with a $10,000 electric car, the Viking, the electric Viking. It's $10,000 and it uses sulfur ion batteries instead of lithium. Is that the way to bring down the cost?
Yeah, there's a number of new battery technologies that are coming out. Tesla is, and they did cover this in their presentation on Wednesday. They are basically sticking with lithium and nickel, and this is because that's where the higher performance batteries come from. So they need higher performance batteries to do the exciting things with electric cars, and their cars are, you know, they're full size or even greater with this new Cybertruck, and they're very fast, and they've got very good range. You can do some pretty interesting things with sodium ion batteries and other configurations, but they lack the power and they lack the range. But for certain applications, it would work just fine, and you could charge way less for it. But I don't know if Tesla's got if Tesla comes out with a $25,000 car that's in the ballpark with the other Tesla vehicles, people are going to opt for that. It's going to be a very, very difficult competition for companies like Volkswagen. Toyota hasn't even started in the competition yet. Volkswagen's in there, but they're lagging way behind. BMW, Mercedes, their General Motors, Chrysler, Ford. Ford's got a number of offerings, but they're struggling a bit with the batteries. One of the things that Tesla emphasized on Wednesday was how they do almost all of their own design and manufacturing work. They mentioned, for example, that Apple, with all their computers and stuff, they outsourced pretty much all of their manufacturing. So Apple didn't have their in-house manufacturing, whereas Tesla designs the products that they make to be manufactured by Tesla. And they did announce a new factory in Monterrey, Mexico, which is about 6 or 7 hour drive. It's about 350 miles south of Austin, Texas. So the world headquarters, this manufacturing headquarters, at least anyway, is alleged to be in Austin, Texas. That was the announcement about a year ago. And now there's going to be a Mexico factory in Monterrey. They still have one in California, and they still have one in China, and they still have one in Germany. And they feel they need about 20 of those kind of factories to meet their goal, which is 20 million vehicles per year by 2030. So they've got to build another 15. Hopefully Canada might get one. Indonesia, because Indonesia's got a lot of the metals for the batteries, probably is in line to get one. India, for sure, has got to be on the list. Another one in Europe besides the one in Germany. But the thing is, for Tesla, it's easier and easier to build these factories because they learn so much from the, you know, they're fine tuning all the time, and they can repeat. They can just copy and paste the design. They also showed their robot, and they showed the robot, the Tesla robot, and what the robot was doing was building other robots. So they showed a robot building a robot. It's quite.
Well, with the labor shortages in North America, I guess robots make sense. But once the robots take over, what do the humans do to stay alive?
Well, Elon Musk sort of philosophized a bit about that. I said, what is the meaning of an economy if, you know, you got GDP per capita, right? So you got, you know, a billion people. But he said at one point you might have 2 billion robots and only 1 billion people. So in an area. So what is the production? You know, the robot never needs to be fed or never needs to sleep, never needs a day off. So, humans might just be, somebody still has to, supervise. Well, maybe not. I mean, if the robots can build other robots, the robots can probably supervise other robots too. one of the biggest causes of death in factories now is when the robots are manufacturing something, and something goes wrong. What they're supposed to do, and it halts the assembly line, and then these people are going to get criticized for slow production. So they call the robot team to come and restart the robot, but what people do is they figured out what the team does when they come. Sometimes it takes an hour for the team to arrive, so they already figure, they've watched the team do and they know what the team does, so they say, oh, I'm going to go and do it myself rather than wait an hour for them to come. They jump inside the fence where the robots are and do whatever it is, and then they get killed because the robot kills them. So this is the future.
Well, in Japan, they have had death by robot on an auto assembly line. Somebody got welded to death.
Oh yeah, no, they certain safety features, and of course, people are always trying to figure out ways to do it faster, so they cut a few corners, and the next thing you know, the robot slices them in half or something. It's terrible, but we're going to have to learn how to live with robots, because I'd encourage people to watch that. I'll tweet something out tomorrow on Friday with a link to the presentation. The robot thing is sort of in the middle of the, if you're watching it on YouTube, it's about halfway through. It's about 2.5 hours into it or something like that. It's about a 4-hour total thing. So you can skip through to that one if you want to watch the robots. It's pretty good. I mean, it's kind of like these engineers aren't always the best communicators, including Elon Musk. You have to criticize him. He's not the best communicator in the world sometimes, I put it up to 1.25 times speed or even 1.5 times speed, but that's got some disadvantages too, because some of them talk really fast already, so you can barely make out what they're saying. But 4 hours is a long time.
What's going on with the Alberta oil patch? The government there announcing a large surplus because of excess oil revenue last year, and are we going to see record high gasoline prices again this summer and fall? Don't forget, in September in Vancouver, we were paying $2.67 a liter. That's $10.68 per Canadian gallon of gasoline.
Yeah, until the electric car takes over from the ICE internal combustion engine car, the demand for oil and crude oil in the U.S. is the big you know, there's 80 million, 100 million barrels a day of oil produced, and 20 million of them are gobbled up by the U.S. So with less than 5% of the population, they're using 20% of the oil. So, and Canada's lucky to be right next to the U.S. and Alberta's lucky to have all this oil, and Alberta's making a lot of money right now. However, there's a few clouds on the horizon. One a little bit further away on the horizon probably is the electric car, because only 5% of the sales currently in the U.S. are electric, much higher than other countries like China, but the U.S. is still 5%, although it's growing quickly. But more immediately, the more immediate threat is the fact that the U.S. has become the biggest producer of oil in the world. So they're up to 13 million barrels a day. Now, I mentioned the 20 million, so they're still short a few million barrels. But what they're doing is they're exporting. So they're up to 5.5 million. The latest figures just came out. 5.5 million barrels per day of exports out of the U.S. to other countries. They're importing about 4 million from Canada. So basically, if they didn't export any oil, they wouldn't need Canadian oil. Now, the reason that they're doing that is because they've got a different type of oil they're exporting, and Canada's got a, Alberta's got this heavy bitumen type oil, which is useful for certain refineries and certain applications. And those processing plants don't get switched over easily. So that situation will carry on for a while longer, but it's a pretty big threat. In the meantime, though, I think the surplus was like $10 billion. Now, the government of Alberta did their budget on Tuesday this week, and they said they're forecasting only $2 billion surplus next year. But that's, I think, they're misleading people with such a low number, unless the price of oil collapses, which is possible. If the U.S. versus that the U.S. and that it has happened in the past. The U.S. has banned exports. Well, if the U.S. banned exports, as they've done in the past, then immediately there'd be a huge surplus of oil in the U.S. and the price would come way down, because there's no reason because there's a war in Russia and Ukraine for the price of oil to go up in Canada. It's almost entirely Canada and the U.S. Linked, and there's very little interaction with other countries. Canada and the U.S. together could form a pact that wouldn't involve any imports or exports. Would all be done within North America. So it's a complicated thing, but the profits are great right now. They're fantastic profits.
What do you make of the BC government being very reluctant to approve LNG projects at Hillier, or I shouldn't say Hillier to Macbeth, because that's you, but we've had other people on the show explain one of those LNG ships that look like they're carrying three giant golf balls, at least $100 million worth of product in one ship. And if you're getting royalties of, say, just 10%, that goes a long way to funding things like healthcare, highways, and schools. And yet BC is against exporting something that we have a 200-year proven reserve of. Does that make sense?
Well, I think what happened was it's one way of looking at it. The industry might say the BC government was reluctant to approve it, but it's also, there's also, because it's exporting out of Canada, it's a federal government approval as well. And then there's some interprovincial, some of the gas is in northeastern BC, some of the gas is in northwestern Alberta. And, but the big problem is not that. That is, and then there's approvals you need from various governments and Aboriginal people and all that. And it's a big deal. The bigger problem, though, is that Canada's missed the boat. So the Australians, which have arguably a better direct access for their liquefied natural gas, and in other countries like Qatar and even the U.S. Gulf Coast, they've moved ahead very quickly. They've got all kinds of excess natural gas. That 5 million barrels a day of oil exported from the U.S., a lot of it's going out of Texas through the Gulf Coast. There's a tremendous amount of natural gas associated with that. They can't find markets for it. So they built a bunch of liquefaction plants, and they're shipping that natural gas to Europe now because of the breakdown in Russian supply of natural gas to Europe. So Canada's so far behind, we're basically out of the game. And whose fault was it? It's hard to say. I mean, was it that there were three or four proposals at one point for new projects on the west coast of BC? I think only one went ahead. There's one that's still under construction. But the other ones, for whatever reason, whether it was the companies or the government or whatever, they never got their act together. And now I think it's too late, because obviously, there's other people that picked up the slack, and there's not going to be a shortage because you don't want to spend all that money. And it's quite expensive. Now, I think one of the problems might have been that the Canadian natural gas was going to be more expensive than, say, the Australian version or the American version. You don't want to invest all those billions of dollars in infrastructure and then find out that there's a surplus. I mean, people like the Japanese and the Chinese and all, they would love to have three or four new projects going because then they can play one off against the other and get an even cheaper price. But it doesn't necessarily mean there's any profits for the BC government out of that.
Mm-hmm. Hilliard, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
Well, watch the. We got through this whole interview without talking about real estate prices, mm-hmm. and it's interesting because some realtors and some people in the industry are touting a resurgence in prices coming back and trying to generate a little fear of missing out among people. But generally, the activity levels are really low, and some of the numbers have been delayed from BC because they don't have the data. The data isn't, they don't have enough. It might be that they don't have enough transactions to report, or maybe it's because the news is so bad they don't want to release it. But at any rate, the prices have come down in some areas quite substantially. Some parts of Ontario near Toronto, like Peterborough, that benefited from that COVID surge where people wanted to move out of the big city, prices are already down 25%, and they'll probably fall further. These interest rates at these levels, there's so many buyers that are just completely out of the market, off the table. They can't participate. That the activity levels have completely dried up, and the sellers are still stubborn. They don't want to lower their prices. And so you got a situation where the market is kind of frozen. And nobody knows which way it's going to break, whether it breaks lower, you know, prices go down even further, or whether maybe interest rates come down and the return to rising prices comes back. I'm betting on the first, that it would be that when the things break, there'll be a bunch of people that are stuck with interest payments that they can't make, and they're forced to sell at lower prices. But could be wrong. Maybe it'll go the other way. But I would wait and see which way it breaks before getting too aggressive either way.
Hilliard, what's going on with house prices?
Well, the house price index that is reported, there's two different indices in Canada. There's the Canadian Real Estate Association, the CREA, and they produce a monthly report on house prices. But there's another one called Terranet National Bank House Price Index, and they try to be a little bit more rigorous, I guess, if you like. They try to find a house that is sold multiple times and use that as an indication to get away from some of the problems with other house price indices that are measuring apples and oranges sometimes. But what's happened in British Columbia, for the January data, which should be out now, is usually comes out February 17th, and it's now early March, and the data is not yet. And Terranet National Bank has put out a report saying that they don't have enough data from the British Columbia data providers. And I think what it is there just haven't been enough sales, or the results are so bad that they don't want to talk about it. So, but they've decided to not include any data from the Vancouver, Victoria, Kelowna, and Abbotsford Mission locations. So I think basically it's probably because they just didn't have enough data points. They thought that the industry would be misleading. But, of course, I'm always thinking, well, if it was misleading on the upside, they probably would have published it. But if it's misleading on the downside, they're going to not publish it. But in any case, that's what's happening in Vancouver right now. There's the data is either so bad or there's so little data that they can't even publish their house price index for January.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. Where can people get that book?
They can buy it at Chapters Indigo, on Amazon, any of those places. And it's interesting, you know, it's in the book. The second edition came out now 5 years ago. Pretty soon it'll be 5 years. And I have to say that the information in that book has held up really well. Obviously, it was early, but it's held up really well in terms of predicting what's happening right now. So if people want to find out why we're going through what we're going through right now and how it's likely to play out, it's in the book.
Check out Hilliard's website, MacBethMacLeodPartners.com. You can also find him on Twitter at HMacBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. Thank you for listening. I'm Jim Godrich.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.